This time on Profiles. The journalism ethics expert who led the task force which examined NPR's ethics code in the aftermath of the dismissal of commentator Juan Williams. Robert Steele is Distinguished Professor of Journalism Ethics at DePauw University and directs its Prindle Institute for Ethics. I'm your host, Perry Metz. Mr. Steele, you've led scores of ethics reviews around the country. Is it fair to say you're the emergency room doctor called in when a journalism organization injures itself?
I think that's a fair description to say that I'm called in those emergency situations, and that's often the case with news organizations where they've had some troubles and they give me a ring and say, come help us out. I've joked over the years that I'm a bit like Red Adair, the late oil well firefighter who was called in when there was a big oil well fire going on. In situations where I'm called in, the first thing I do is try and understand what's going on, get a good understanding, ascertainment of the situation. I ask lots of questions and then do my best to help them make good decisions to address whatever challenges they have.
How often are you called in when there isn't a problem, just to address these ideas?
Yeah. Well, good editors and executive producers and journalists are thinking about ethics all the time. And over the last 25 years, I've had hundreds of calls, probably thousands, literally, of phone calls from good journalists who say, I'm thinking about this particular issue. Might have to do with a conflict of interest, might have to do with an investigative story, might have to do with covering vulnerable people. And they'll say, help us think about this before we get into dicey territory. So what happens a lot where journalists call me and say, help me think through this situation. It also happens fairly often where a news organization does have problems and they ring me up and say, will you come and do some attending to the challenges we face?
Let's turn to that very specific incident, which has certainly put you in the news and at the forefront of journalism this year. Let me play this audio clip of the original remarks that Juan Williams made in a conversation with Bill O'Reilly on Fox.
So where am I going wrong there, Juan?
Well, actually, I hate to say this to you because I don't want to get your ego going, but I think you're right. I think, look, political correctness can lead to some kind of paralysis where you don't address reality. I mean, look, Bill, I'm not a bigot. You know the kind of books I've written about the civil rights movement in this country. But when I get on a plane, I got to tell you, if I see people who are in Muslim garb, and I think, you know, they're identifying themselves first and foremost as Muslims, I get worried. I get nervous. Now, I remember also that when that Times Square bomber was at court, he said the war with Muslims, America's war with is just beginning, first drop of blood. I don't think there's any way to get away from these facts, but I think there are people who want to somehow remind us all, as President Bush did after 9/11, it's not a war against Islam. President Bush went to a mosque.
Well, there isn't any theology involved in this at all from my perspective, Juan, but you live in the liberal precincts. Yeah, you actually work for NPR.
What's wrong with that as an expression of his opinion?
Let me set the context, if I could, in terms of my role here. That's important. NPR journalists, including Ellen Weiss, the former senior VP of news, have called me many times over the years to ask for guidance on ethics issues. And many NPR journalists and senior news executives came to Poynter seminars and workshops on ethics and leadership. So it was not unusual for NPR journalists to ask me to help them think through ethics issues. In this particular case, I did not have a call from NPR, and I was only called in after this particular situation by Vivian Schiller, the now former CEO of NPR, to help them think through ethics standards and practices at NPR. Part of the reason for that was what transpired with the Juan Williams situation and related to that interview cut with O'Reilly that Williams just did that we heard. So it's important to put in context my role there. I was not called in specifically because of this particular situation. And my role is not to make a decision to decide right or wrong in terms of what Juan Williams did in that particular circumstance. Personally, I do have some concerns about the way in which he expressed himself and the framing of the way in which he expressed his concern about Muslims. He did later in that interview with Juan Williams say that it was unfair for Bill O'Reilly or anybody else to stereotype a group of individuals, Muslims or others, by virtue of who they are, how they look, how they dress. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he said that several minutes after he had made this original comment. And therefore, I think it created a very problematic situation of expressing that opinion in that format at that time about a very volatile issue here in our society. So there are some dynamics that were at play there. Then, as we know, the NPR made the decision to terminate Juan Williams' contract, and Mr. Williams was not at all happy about that. He's continued to raise concerns about it, raising concerns in his book, Muzzled, and feels that he was treated unfairly by NPR. My role was not to make any kind of decision as to how he was treated or the way in which NPR handled that, but rather to look at NPR's standards and practices for ethics and the way in which NPR journalists and executives go about their decision making.
Well, when you headed that task force to examine the NPR ethics code and procedures, your task force recommended that NPR curtail and control appearances by reporters acting as pundits, not allowing long-term contracts for those roles. Why can't their knowledgeable analysis, labeled as such, help the public gain a deeper understanding of important news stories?
That analysis based on the journalism can be very important. And we talked about this at great length among the 13 members of the task force. And I had recommended to NPR in square one that we create that task force, which included seven employees of NPR, five from within news, two outside of news, as well as four other very good journalists from around the country and two citizens who are longtime listeners of NPR. And the task force put a great deal of value on analysis that is directly connected to and built upon journalistic knowledge and journalistic skills. But we drew a distinction between that kind of analysis and opinion, point of view expressed by individuals, including journalists. And it's the belief of the task force and was included in our recommendations that NPR should draw a very clear distinction. There should be journalistic reporting, which includes substantive, knowledgeable, skilled analysis based on the journalism. And there can be commentary expressed by individuals who are commentators and who express opinions and point of view. That middle territory of analysis, which was quasi-commentary and quasi-reporting, is the problem area. And our recommendation was that you not have analysts who are also giving point of view. You have journalists who are doing analysis based on reporting and their knowledge, and you have commentators who are doing opinion.
That touches on the role of the late Dan Shore, former CBS newsman who served many years as an NPR analyst. And I asked Vivian Schiller early in her term whether we should be comfortable as NPR stations in having only one or two major news analysts, both of whom had pretty liberal perspectives, not because that wasn't a valid viewpoint, but because we didn't have a prominent name analyst who had a more conservative view. And she rejected that. She said that she thought that the analyst position was clearly identified on NPR and that that wasn't a problem. I'm hearing you draw a distinction there.
Well, the task force and I, in my opinion, tried to draw that distinction. And I believe that Vivian understood where we were coming from and accepted that recommendation. And we presented it to the NPR board in February. She then left NPR several weeks after that. But my sense was that the emphasis we placed on that distinction was both appropriate and on the mark. And I think Vivian heard that and agreed that there could be and should be that kind of distinction. I agree with you that there should be a range range of perspectives within the commentary that NPR or any organization has. A good newspaper and its op-ed page has a range of different perspectives across a broad ideological spectrum. And NPR, if it does commentary, and it does do commentary, should have a range of perspective in terms of multiple ideological perspectives.
You phrased both here with me and in the things you've written, you phrased your recommendations to NPR about ways to improve its ethics code, to share information with reporters and producers, to encourage training, all very forward-looking. But knowing what had happened, what's your assessment of how seriously this incident damaged NPR's reputation and credibility?
Well, there's no doubt that NPR took a hit in the public sector because of this particular situation, and there have been a couple others. The reality is all news organizations at one time or another take some brickbats and smacks on the noggin and on the shins. In this one, it was a fairly high-profile situation. I think in the short term, there was a real hit on credibility. There were a number of politicians who picked up on this situation involving Juan Williams and used it as an argument, I think improper at times, for why the financial underpinnings of public radio should be changed, and in fact why public funding, government funding of NPR and NPR member stations should be changed and in fact argued for eliminated in many cases. I think that was a wrong-headed idea and it was inappropriate in terms of a response. That said, what transpired at NPR last fall and into the winter was a serious situation in which NPR executives had to address what it meant to their credibility. I think they were very wise to take a step back and create this task force and ask us to look at NPR's ethics standards to make sure they were clear, make sure they were consistent, make sure they were meaningful. And I think that we as a task force have done a very good job on this. We have written new guiding principles that, while they're not new in a sense of the spirit of capturing accuracy, fairness, completeness, independence, honesty, and the other principles that guide NPR, they are stated more clearly and more compellingly. We also recommended a new, more practical handbook of news ethics, which takes the various standards and practices and puts them in a more meaningful, clear way, including guidelines for use of social media, which NPR had written in recent years, but were a separate document. This new handbook will include a lot of case studies, a lot of practical advice, and most importantly, it'll raise lots of questions which the journalists and the news executives have to ask themselves at intersections over and over. It puts a lot more responsibility and decision-making role in the hands of managers at NPR, as well as responsibility for the journalists. But I think that's very important when it comes to ethics. Ethics should not be about rule books, because rules imply and lead to rigidity, and that gets in the way of good decision-making. Yes, you need clear guiding principles. You also need strong guidelines, but then you have to make good decisions at the intersection of competing principles every day.
Obviously, I recognize many of those phrases from the report that you wrote and that the task force submitted. One of the interesting things I noticed was that you recommended a more nuanced guidebook, but also, if you will, an executive summary, some guiding principles that people could use as a touchstone, even as they might refer to a more detailed handbook.
That's correct. And one of the reasons we did that is the experience that I and other journalists have had in lots of news organizations around the country. And I've recommended a number of times, and news organizations have put in place this combination of guiding principles and strong guidelines with a clear process for making decisions. In this case, as part of the task force effort, I also went to NPR member stations in St. Louis, Phoenix, and Orlando and held sessions with about 65, 70 citizens citizens in those communities. We asked those citizens to ahead of time read the NPR News Code of Ethics, which has been in existence for a decade or more, and bring us their thoughts, deconstruct it. Where are the strengths? Where are the weaknesses? Where are the ways in which this code could be better written and more articulate in both its aspiration and its inspiration? And that was very helpful to us to hear the views of these citizens combined with the views of hundreds of employees at NPR with whom I and others at a task force talked. So out of all that, we said, let's put the guiding principles into a much stronger, clearer constitution, if you will, and then build on that the guidelines and the process for decision making. And I think it's headed in a very good direction. Ideally, we'll have this finished by the end of August, presented to the NPR board in September, and conduct a series of ongoing workshops throughout NPR for all 800 or so employees this fall. And we also, to the degree that member stations around the country here in Bloomington, Indianapolis, and Minneapolis, and Portland, Maine, and Portland, Oregon, and across the country are interested, to also help the member stations take these guiding principles and these guidelines and put them in effect at the local level.
How different were the comments from ordinary citizens, people who are longtime listeners? How different were those comments from the ones you received from working journalists?
I think there was a real similarity in terms of the importance of having greater clarity and a more substantive aspirational code. There's a lot of good in the existing NPR News Code of Ethics, but like a lot of codes of ethics, it has been hammered together and then rebuilt at different times with additions to it. And so there were not only some places that new guidelines were needed, but some of the language was just not as clear as it should be. But the one thing that the citizens emphasized over and over was how important NPR journalism is across this country in an era in which many news organizations, particularly television networks and now many newspapers because of economic reasons, have cut back their reporting in this country and particularly in international coverage. NPR remains one of the strongest news organizations in this country and in the world. And so the citizens in St. Louis, Orlando, and Phoenix, and others I talked to in other places around the country, emphasized over and over of how important NPR journalism is at the national level and at the local level. And let's get it really sharp. Let's make it even better. That's what I heard over and over. We believe in it, and we want it to be as good as it can be.
Before we go any further, let me review very quickly some of the basic recommendations from the task force and ask you to tell me if I've left anything major out. The task force recommended labeling more clearly news and commentary and broadcasts, training reporters and managers in ethics, clarifying to whom these guidelines apply, including freelancers and programs that NPR may get from other sources, hiring a standards and practices officer who might both model good behavior and serve as a resource for people in the newsroom, and reviewing conflict of interest policies. Have I left anything out?
Without looking at those recommendations, I think that pretty well captures it. I have to think about it. There was a lot of emphasis on transparency being very important. We put a lot of emphasis on the ongoing training and development. And just to clarify one point, at one point the word officer was used in relation to standards and practices, but the term that we applied in the end of the recommendation was a standards and practices editor. Mm-hmm. This was something I strongly believed in, that we should think about ethics in a sense of a collaborative process in which good decisions are made based on principles and guidelines. Officer implies a heavy-handed rule, which is not what we were in any way advocating.
Media history buffs recognize that phrase. Standards and practices was the feared department at the television networks in the 50s, who were always deciding what words were allowed to be used on television, what things could be depicted. And it was their sense, very hard to pin down, about what was acceptable to the American public. But your distinction here of an editor is someone, again, who would raise questions, discuss nuances of the decision-making process rather than someone who would issue edicts. Is that right?
That's quite correct. There is no direct relationship between standards and practices as we recommended it and that historical piece, if you go back to the 50s and 60s, of the way it was set up in broadcast organizations. This standards and practice editor concept is much more like what the New York Times has with a standards and practices editor. It's somebody within the news organization who helps interpret the existing standards and practices and guidelines within ethics within the organization, ask tough questions at key moments along the way. And our recommendation, NPR, is that this individual be someone who is not making the decisions when it comes to day-in, day-out coverage or a big investigative story or any other kind of ethics issue. He or she is not making the decisions, but asking the right questions to get people to think harder on a continuing basis and offering guidance and input and insight and advice to the senior executives at news and elsewhere within NPR so that they too can make good final decisions.
Before we leave this topic, I wanted to get your thoughts on a particular sentence that was most striking to me, buried in most accounts of the task force's work. You made a statement that the most common problem you've found in news organizations you've worked with all across the country is that reporters don't really know the guidelines of their own organizations, that they're not clear to them. They may not have read the most recent version, and there hasn't been much discussion. What does that say about the ability of the watchdogs to watch themselves?
Well, this is true not only in news organizations, but in most organizations across this country and perhaps around the world. Certainly my experience in times when I've worked with other organizations beyond the media, it doesn't say something that is positive, that's for sure. The reason one an organization has standards and practices and call it a code of ethics or call it something else is to make sure that all the employees of the organization are aware of what the expectations are when it comes to ethical standards and to have everybody on the same page. As I've said before, I don't believe that the ethics standards and practices should be a rigid rule book. I think that gets in the way of good decision making. But it should be clear principles to say this is what we stand for in terms of our ethical obligations and responsibilities in our professional role. In the case of journalism, accuracy, fairness, completeness, honesty, independence, impartiality, accountability, transparency, respect, and excellence. The principles that will guide us, and each of those principles is fleshed out with specific guidelines to help the journalists, in this case at NPR, make decisions in terms of investigative reporting, in terms of covering tragedy, in terms of breaking news, in terms of avoiding conflicts of interest. And ideally, the employees of a news organization and any organization are aware of those standards, talk about them, and use them as guideposts in the day-to-day work that they conduct. Standards of practices also protect the employees by saying, here are the boundaries, here are the guardrails when it comes to independence and avoiding conflict of interest, for instance, to make sure that the journalists don't find themselves in a minefield where they have competing loyalties and a conflict of interest that it would erode the credibility and integrity not only of their own journalism but of the organization.
For our listeners who are interested in reading the NPR guidelines for themselves, along with the social media guidelines, I'll tell you that after our break, I will be giving the web address in case you'd like to get a pencil and paper to take that down. Let's take a break now and listen to your first selection that you brought by a favorite in these parts, Carrie Newcomer. If you'd tell us why you picked this.
Well, she is a Hoosier songwriter and musician. She's terrific in terms of the way in which she captures the quality, the ethos, the culture of Indiana. I grew up in small town Indiana, so when I first heard this song that Carrie wrote and performs of I Wish I May, I Wish I Might, and she talks about summer in Indiana and other times of year too, the fall and the spring and the winter in some ways, particularly the summer and the fall, and county fairs and church gatherings and all the special things of Indiana. I knew that this song was about where I grew up and what I consider very special about Indiana.
Mm-hmm. Sweet corn days in Oakland City, the Apple Fest in Napanee, the Blueberry Cavalcade, the Sacred Heart Polish Days, Oktoberfest in Rensselaer, Marshmallow Days in Ligonier, the Feast of the Hunter's Moon, the Pork and Pumpkin Rendezvous. This year's county fair, all our friends will be there. Gather kin and cousins near, and everything we love is here.
This is Profiles. Today, talking with Bob Steele, journalistic ethicist and the head of the recent NPR task force looking at the NPR ethics code. As promised, for our listeners interested in seeing the current NPR ethics code, you can find it online at npr.org/about/aboutnpr/ethics.
Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net.
When and how will we know if your work with NPR has been effective?
Well, I think there are several standards that we, the public, can judge this by. I hope that in the day-to-day journalism of NPR, on the air and online and any other form of digital delivery that folks use to get NPR journalism, it will speak of excellence. It will speak in excellence in terms of knowledge of the subjects being covered, excellence in terms of the craft skills that the journalists at NPR bring to the table in terms of storytelling, not just the correspondents and reporters across the country and around the world, but the editors and the producers and the audio technicians and the engineers and all the other support personnel at NPR who help make NPR what it is. This is NPR, as the term is appropriately used. So I think one of the important standards is to gauge day in and day out the quality of the journalism. Does it measure up in its accuracy, its fairness, its completeness? I think it's also important for NPR to scrutinize itself in a rigorous and continuous basis in the same way that NPR would scrutinize the government, major companies, churches, and other religious faiths in this country as part of the coverage. This scrutinizing takes place in a couple ways. NPR has an ombudsman and has for more than a decade now. The new ombudsman, Edward Schumacher Matos, is a very skilled and smart journalist who has done a great deal of fine writing over the years for newspapers. He's taught journalism. He actually ran a newspaper at one point. He started in June of this year, succeeding Alicia Shepard, who was the ombudsman for the previous 3 years, and did a very good job of holding NPR accountable. Schumacher Matos's columns, and you can see these on the NPR site on a regular basis. You can also have them sent to you by email on a regular basis. So both his columns and ongoing blogging shine that bright light of scrutiny on NPR and at times critically raise questions about certain kind of reporting. And I hope that through the ombudsman column and through the way listeners and online users of NPR gauge the journalism, we can see how this long process of tightening the standards and practices at NPR plays out. Much of what is happening with the standards and practices and the new principles and guidelines is internal. It's the hands-on, the machinery day in and day out. It's editors and reporters asking really hard questions of each other and editors prosecuting stories on the way in which a reporter uses a single verb or an adverb and saying, is that fair in this particular case? Is this precise in the way in which it was taking place in this particular story? And so that's not easily seen by the public, but it is a terrific responsibility internally for the journalists at NPR. And I would hope that the work of this task force and the work of lots of journalists within NPR in creating these new guidelines is productive in that sense and makes a strong news organization even stronger in excellence and in ethics.
That's a very interesting explanation. That makes me want to ask your opinion of a somewhat larger issue. The trend over the last 20 years for virtually any prominent journalist to become sought after on the lecture circuit, as a guest on late night television, as a person of interest on cable talk shows, putting the journalist out of his or her typical role and making them more of either a commentator or an entertainer, and the opportunity to speak then goes far beyond their role as a journalist.
It does, and it creates some real challenges for individual journalists and for their news organizations. And we've talked about this a lot in the task force that is reviewing the NPR ethics standards. I've had lots of conversations with Margaret Lowe Smith, who is the acting senior VP of news at NPR, who's a terrific journalist and smart as a whip, and others in the NPR senior news management team. And they are moving towards clearer standards for their journalists so that when NPR journalists are in any way offering their expertise, whether it's on other news programs, on television or online or in any other media platform, or whether the NPR journalists are speaking to the public at a university gathering or some other sort of public function, that the journalists can offer their analysis based on their journalistic knowledge and their skills. But the journalist should not be venturing into the personal opinion arena unless they are strictly commentators in NPR. If they are the journalists who are doing the reporting, they should not be offering their personal point of view and opinion.
To really reach back, that almost sounds like a call for commentators to be restricted to the role that Eric Severide used to play on CBS News. He was not, during that period, a reporter. He simply was a commentator on the issues of the day. Later, John Chancellor on NBC. Is that more the kind of acceptable role you see?
It's the recommendation of the task force, and it's a role that I would champion personally and in my professional expertise with journalism ethics. Many of us in the public, and I put myself in that role at times as well because I'm a consumer of news and all platforms, find it increasingly challenging to understand the distinction of journalists who at one moment are covering a story and the next moment are serving as pundits. Sometimes they're writing columns for their own newspaper or doing commentary for their own broadcast organization or doing it online, in which they are clearly offering point of view right after and right before again they are covering that same issue in government, in the economy, in religion, in sports, in environmental issues, whatever their specialty is. And I think, A, that's very confusing to the public to try and figure out, okay, when is Bob Steele being a journalist in reporting and when is Bob Steele being an opinion offerer in this situation? So that in itself is confusing. And I think it's very unfair to those we cover. Why should a congresswoman or a state legislator or the owner of a business or the manager of a baseball team trust a journalist who at one minute is going to be asking questions as a reporter and ideally writing a fair, accurate, independent story, and that same journalist then puts on a different hat 2 hours later and is a pundit in which he or she, the journalist, is raising personal opinion thoughts about that business or that church or that government agency or that lawmaker or that team. I don't think it can work in the sense of independent, substantive, professional journalism.
Now, you've not simply been someone who studied journalism and values. You spent almost a decade as a reporter and producer in Iowa and Maine. You have a master's in radio and TV from Syracuse and a doctorate in journalistic ethics and ethical decision-making from the University of Iowa. What was a time when your own ethics were tested?
Well, there have been many times over the years when I was first a reporter. There were a lot of stories in which I had to work extra hard to make sure that a story was accurate and fair when the details weren't clear. My first professional job after graduate school was in Bangor, Maine, working for an NBC television station, small station. And so I and the other three reporters did a lot of things, often right. in the same day. I would go to the State House in Augusta and cover politics, and that might be environmental stories, or it might be stories dealing with the legislative process or covering the governor. And then I would also do a couple other stories in communities on the way back from Augusta to Bangor. And at times, I would do the sports on the evening newscasts and try and do a couple local sports stories on the university or local teams. So there were a lot of challenges trying to nail down a story, be fair and accurate when you're doing lots of things at the same time. There was a period in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where I was an assistant news director and executive producer of an ABC television station, in which we were doing some pretty substantive project and investigative reporting. And I can remember some real knockdown dragouts with our investigative reporter, who was quite good, but he also had some edge about him. And that's partly what made him good. Mm. But there were times in which I had to challenge him in terms of where he was going in a story to make sure that he stayed with inside the guardrails in terms of fairness and accuracy. He did. And he really did some great investigative reporting. But those are some examples of when it would come up in day-to-day journalism.
Many of our listeners may recognize the place that you taught for 20 years, the Poynter Institute for Media Studies in St. Petersburg, Florida. Nelson Poynter was an IU grad, a friend of Herman Wells, and university benefactor. He even established a center here for the study of American institutions. How did you connect with the Poynter Institute in Florida?
Serendipity, in many ways. After starting on my PhD at the University of Iowa, had gone back to the state of Maine, where I had been a working journalist, and gone back to teach at the University of Maine while I was finishing my PhD. And at some point in the mid-1980s, one of my colleagues said, "Do you know about the Poynter Institute and these seminars that they run for journalism educators?" And I said, "Gee, I don't." And I looked it up and found out that there was one coming up for those who taught journalism ethics. And that was becoming my specialty. I was doing my PhD dissertation on journalism ethics and finished it on that. So I went to the Poynter Institute in a seminar and had a great experience. Some really bright folks from around the country, almost all like myself, had been journalists in the trenches and then gone back to graduate school and were now teaching journalism in one form or another. And I had a great experience, very stimulating. And at the time, the Poynter Institute was looking for someone to take over their ethics program and lead it, and they asked me to do that. The timing wasn't quite right for me for a couple reasons, and I love living in Maine and had no desire to live in Florida. So I actually took a pass on the job a couple of times, but we reconnected within a couple of years, and they asked me to reconsider and take the position, and I went there in 1989. And within about 4 hours of being there, I knew it was a phenomenal job, that it was the right place for me, gave me the opportunity to keep working with newsrooms across the country and increasingly around the world with very bright journalists, and I think a very stimulating role. It was a one-of-a-kind role in American journalism, and not only running workshops for journalists at Poynter, but going to newsrooms around the country, in which I did extensively. Probably the favorite thing of my work at the Poynter Institute, and I still continue it now in my role at DePaul University, is being on call, being what we came to term a rabbi, of being ready with some good questions and ideally some insight to virtually any ethics issue that would emerge in a newsroom here in this country or around the world. And so I would regularly, and still do, get phone calls from editors and producers and reporters and other executives in the news business, including owners who have called me on occasion and say, "Help me think this through. Help me think about this investigative story." Or, "We're dealing with a natural disaster and trying to be as aggressive as we can and as compassionate as we can." Or conflicts of interest issues. I would say over the years that at least a third, and maybe even approaching a half, of the ethics issues that have been posed to me had competing loyalty elements to them, and in some way either a real or a perceived conflict of interest. It's always a challenging area. My role has been to help the journalists sort it out, think through the issues, ask hard questions of themselves, and make good decisions.
My mother used to say, if you think you might have a conflict of interest. How would you feel about it being on the front page of the paper? Right. How useful is that as shorthand for making a decision?
I think it's a reasonable. We've used that and others comparable to it. You're driving down the road, you see a billboard, there's your story on the billboard. But I think it's a good way to do it. And one of the reasons it's essential for journalists to do it is in journalism, we do and we should shine a light of scrutiny on conflicts of interest in other organizations in our society. We report about competing loyalties and conflicts of interest between lawmakers and lobbyists, between local government officials and developers. We report on conflicts of interest between physicians and pharmaceutical companies, and on and on. We shine the light of scrutiny when others have conflicts of interest, which erode their credibility and can harm the public in one way or another. We indeed should do it very intensely and rigorously on ourselves in journalism.
I want to be sure we have a chance to play your second selection, something you brought. What is the import of this song?
I grew up in the 50s and 60s, at least tried to grow up. We never know whether we truly grow up. And this song, Where Have All the Flowers Gone, spoke to the times of the 50s and particularly the 60s and the early 70s. I happened to go in the Army when I graduated from DePauw in 1969 and was an Army officer and went to Vietnam. So this song in many ways reflected the tensions of that era of how we were dealing with a war that so many of us in this country were struggling to figure out whether it was right and how to get out of it when we decided it was wrong.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? Young girls have picked them, every one. Oh, when will they ever learn? Oh, when will they ever learn? Where have all the young girls gone? Long time passing. Where have all
We're back on Profiles, talking today with Bob Steele, who is the head of the Prindle Institute for Ethics at DePauw University and also a distinguished professor there. Mr. Steele, you returned after 20 years teaching at Poynter. You returned to DePauw, where you earned your bachelor's degree, and you teach seminars there now on leadership and on journalism ethics. But it's your first year class that fascinates me, a class on values, beliefs, and storytelling. How would you describe it?
I've always enjoyed struggling with ethics issues and values issues. I can remember growing up in small town Indiana, and in my classrooms and at home, I would constantly be asking the question, why? In fact, I used to doodle the word why in lots of different fonts and scripts. And to this day, it intrigues me of not only why we believe as we do, but why we make decisions as we do. When DePauw asked me to come back and teach several years ago and then eventually become the director of the Ethics Institute, I wanted to be as close as I could to the students of this era in terms of helping them think through these issues of values and ethics. I had that opportunity back in the 60s at DePauw as a student there, when we had professors who really pushed us to think about civil rights and the Vietnam War, the women's movement, the environmental movement. And so I borrowed the "this I believe" concept from the series of essays that have been airing on public radio for the last 4 or 5 years, and used the title and the framework to create a first-year seminar, "This I Believe: Storytelling About Our Core Values," in which the students read and listen to some of these essays that have been aired on public radio and published in several books now, to help the students think about values through the lens of lots of others. And then I asked the students to think about places in their lives and people in their lives and to explore what's important to them and what their values are. Students write a great deal in this class. else. We are very discussion-oriented and probing. We explore the contentious issues of society, but always through the lens of the individual and the person.
If I could read one paragraph from the course description you wrote, it made an impact on me. This is aimed, obviously, at an incoming freshman at DePaul. As you make the transition from hometown and high school to Greencastle and DePaul, your stories about values reflect your path and your passions. Your stories may speak of loyalty, tested when a friendship endured a breach of faith, of lessons learned when a seemingly sure victory turned into a painful defeat, of confidence gained in mastering a musical instrument or leading a dysfunctional group, of courage displayed by the quiet person who spoke up in challenge against a racist joke when the big talkers were silent. It struck me not only that that would be a fascinating class to take as a freshman, but that it would have new and different meanings if we took it again as each decade passed in our lives.
Well, that's well framed in terms of how we could look at this experience of when we would explore it at 18 or at 78. I wrote that passage in the spirit of how I think about these issues in life. I'm turning 64 this month. And for me, if I think back on my time at DePaul, I wish I had had a class like that as a freshman that had prompted me to and maybe even required me to think about and write about the issues of values in an even more intense way than I did. And I wish that I had maybe done more of that in my time in Vietnam. And I wished I had done more of it in my time in newsrooms as a reporter and a news manager. And I wished I'd done more of it in my years raising three daughters. All of those things are part of my life, and I've probably done it in my head and my heart, but my opportunity now, and I consider it a phenomenally wonderful opportunity to work with these students who are at 18 or 19 years of age, are very interested in writing about these issues. And they write about the joy in their lives, the happiness that comes from a very special relationship with a grandparent. They write about the satisfaction that comes from achieving something wonderful in music or in sports or in academics. They also write about the pain in their lives. They write about divorce in their families, and they write about chemical dependency of parents, and they write about the suicide of best friends and what that means to their values. And I think that's important that they can express themselves ideally in a safe place. I also use this format in a more limited way for DePaul graduates who are coming back for their 50th reunion. So we actually do that. I've done it several times now with folks who are in their early 70s who are coming back to DePaul, and I ask them to write these essays about something they believe in deeply. And they obviously bring that 50 years of experience to their exploration of what their core values are.
I'd love to hear those two groups read their essays to each other.
Yeah.
That sounds fascinating. You shared an essay with me called The Purpose and Power of Questions. In it, you quote extensively from a commencement address given by your DePaul classmate, Jack McQuethy. This is a quote from that speech. "All institutions, all endeavors, all relationships are improved by a good scrubbing using the word why. In democracy, it is the question we must all constantly be asking our government and our leaders. It is not unpatriotic to question the government. It is unpatriotic not to." Isn't that the premise that has bedeviled journalism for decades, whether it is loyal to ask hard questions?
It is a challenge, and it has been a challenge for all journalists across the world, particularly those within democratic societies. Jack McQuethy was a brilliant journalist. I grew up, if you will, in my college years with Jack at DePaul. And we drank a few beers together, and we worked together at the DePaul, the student newspaper. He was the editor, and I was the sports editor, and we were good friends. He went on to a terrific career at U.S. News and World Report, where he covered environment in the White House, and then ABC News for more than a quarter century, where he covered the important issues of the world, including the Pentagon for many years and 24 wars. And he did ask those hard questions over and over to powerful people. He was as sincere as anybody I've ever known in that belief that journalism should hold accountable the powerful, and particularly those who run our government. And that was, as Jack believed, by asking the word why over and over, a true mark of patriotism. And I think it indeed reflects that. I think that we should challenge our institutions, and we should challenge those who lead our government and other organizations in our country to make them justify in a proper, respectful way what they do and why they do it. So journalism should constantly ask the question why. And of course, Jack's point, and one that I agree with 100%, was we all should ask that question of ourselves day in and day out. Not just what should I do, but why should I do what I do?
You're getting at the hallmark of a liberal education, for which DePauw is so well known, the idea of self-examination, not just in college, but throughout one's life and vocations and avocations. I wonder, painting that across a broader streak of society, business, government, education, religion, just how welcome those questions are and how often they're seen as obstacles or a lack of cooperation by the participant.
Mm-hmm. Well, that can certainly happen. A lot of people feel when you put the question up that that you are questioning a person's beliefs, that you're questioning their ethos and their ethics. I don't think it has to be that way. There's a piece of that where you want them to justify what they believe, why they believe as they do, what they stand for. But for the most part, the questions, I believe, should challenge us to think harder, think deeper, have aha moments, and at times recognize that maybe our thinking is not as clear as it is, as we think it is, that times that we don't have enough knowledge, at times we haven't been listening to enough diverse voices and counter opinions, and that we need to be more counterintuitive. I think the best learning takes place when at the table or in the room we have people who are very different, different in their upbringing, different in their life experiences, different in their ideology, different in their religion, different in all the ways that can be important in life, from gender to race to age to work. And then we learn more. If we surround ourselves with people who are like ourselves, I believe that's about as counterproductive a daily life as we could live. We need to be with people who are different and constantly ask those hard questions.
Believing that, how would you advise a strong leader of any of those organizations to balance the need to move ahead decisively with the need to reflect?
They are woven together inextricably. You need to move forward as a leader with passion and purpose. At the same time, a leader should be constantly reflecting, listening closely, observing deeply in what's going on within an organization. I've had this opportunity, as you asked me about at the beginning of this interview, with NPR the past 8 months to spend a lot of time with the leaders there and the journalists at NPR and the other 300 employees who work in support and operational roles. And my hope for and my urging to the leaders at NPR is that they are very reflective. They think about the culture of what takes place at NPR, where the strengths are, where there might be weaknesses in the underbelly of an organization, whether they have enough diversity in all the ways diversity is important, including thought and including ideology, to be asking hard questions of themselves in that reflective process, and at the same time to chart a course to move ahead in the specific area I've worked with them in terms of clearer, more compelling, more well-articulated, inspirational and aspirational principles and guidelines, but also move ahead in terms of the day-to-day practice of high-quality, excellent journalism, which NPR is known for, and to become even better at it. So I think you have to be both reflective and very assertive in the way in which you lead an organization.
You've been listening to Profiles, a conversation with today's guest, journalism ethicist Bob Steele, Distinguished Professor of Journalism Ethics at DePauw University. For Profiles, I'm Perry Metz.
The program you just heard was recorded in July of 2011. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Mia Partlow, producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.